This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we look at a positive program where volunteers commit to regularly visit prisoners over the long term. The benefits of visitation to society are well documented, yet the increasing use of video visitation is posing a challenge. For years, U.S. law enforcement has relied on civil asset forfeiture to meet their budget requirements. A recent unanimous Supreme Court decision will now make it easier for attorneys to challenge these practices in court. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. In hundreds of correctional facilities across the nation, in-person prisoner visits are being phased out. In their place, video technology programs run by private companies like Securus are being introduced. One researcher at the Prison Policy Initiative has pieced together difficult-to-gather statistics. They suggest that at least 600 U.S. prisons already have video visitation programs. In Florida, for example, one retired prison inspector who writes about video visitation says that over the past 5 years, most jails there are using only video visitation and have altogether stopped in-person visits. The Prison Policy Initiative's data suggests that 74% of U.S. correctional facilities that implement video end up either reducing in-person visits or totally eliminating them. Is the elimination of prison visits a human rights violation? Most prisoners already receive few, if any, visitors or have much human contact. Joining us to discuss this issue today is Steve Gotzler, Executive Director of the Prison Visitation and Support. Steve is the former program director at the Pennsylvania Prison Society. He knows firsthand what it's like to spend time in federal prison. Steve, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much, Heidi.
Steve, tell us, how did you come to be interested in prisoners' rights issues and prisoner advocacy?
Well, it's an interesting story, basically from personal experience. I led a colorful past and managed to get in and out of jail a few times in my life, the last time being a fairly lengthy federal sentence, which got me released at the ripe age of 42 years old.
And then you went to law school.
Oh, you bet. It was 3 weeks from release from FCI Oxford in Wisconsin to starting law school at Rutgers in Newark, New Jersey.
Okay, Steve, when you were inside, did you receive many visitors in person?
It depends where I was in the country. That's the real big issue. When you're in the federal system, you're just considered to be in the system. They don't really take too much into account about where you're from originally as to where you get sent. So you can be almost anywhere as long as you're in a Bureau of Prisons prison. So I spent time as far as 1,000, 1,500 miles away from home. But eventually, when I got to Oxford, I was near home, so I got visits there.
Explain briefly, why does the Bureau of Prisons move inmates around so much?
That's a really interesting question. For number one, their main, really main task is just to keep the people they're charged with keeping in custody alive, healthy, in control, and ready in case a court wants them. So other than that, they really don't have a lot of things that they have to do. So when a prisoner goes in to the system, what BOP does is takes into account many different items, including many BOP issues like population control, too many people in this part of the country, too many there, co-defendants maybe who are in a prison that's near your home, so they don't want to send you there, enemies, they don't want to send you there. So the next thing you know, you can be in San Diego. Or if you turn out to be a particularly troublesome prisoner, sometimes being transferred is a form of punishment. So you can be anywhere.
When I've been to visit individuals in prison, I realize that many, many inmates just never get any visits whatsoever. That situation leads us into what you do, which is head the prisoner visitation support. Tell us a bit about that organization. How long has it been around? What do they do?
Sure. Prisoner Visitation and Support is 51 years old this year. It was initially founded as a support group for Vietnam War draft resistors, because back in the 60s, it was going to prison for refusing to go to the draft was a fairly unpleasant experience. You were considered like a traitor, so you were treated poorly by staff and often by other prisoners. And so the war resistors of the time worked out a system of going to visit, because if a prisoner gets visits, their treatment kind of automatically gets much better than if they don't get visits. And over the course of a very short period of time, the original crew of visitors discovered that there was a whole world of people in prison. They were a little bit shocked by that, and so they instantly expanded to visiting anybody who's got a long federal prison sentence or military and who doesn't get much in the way of visits. So Prisoner Visitation and Support is a nationwide network of visitors, volunteer visitors. We have over 600 who sign up, go through a fairly rigorous training and vetting process, and they visit people who ask to be visited, and sometimes we visit people from a third-party recommendation. And we meet them in the visiting room at least once a month, forever, till they're released.
That's quite a commitment on the part of your volunteers.
It's crazy. Yeah, it is. It is. Many of our volunteers have been with us for 30, 40 years. Yeah, it is. It's a very long commitment.
And let's talk about the basics here for people who haven't been to visit a person in prison. What do they talk about?
That's interesting. PBS is a little bit unusual in that it's not a religious organization. We're not there to convert anybody to anything. As a matter of fact, it's against our rules. We're only there to talk to them about whatever they want to talk about. The idea is just being human. The fact that you got yourself into prison somehow, justified or not, doesn't negate the fact that you're just a regular person. And so many of our visitors are operating under some kind of religious instruction. The Bible and other books frequently mention that you should visit people in prison. This is like the lowest point in your life. So what they do is they come in, they talk about music, recipes, politics, sports, books, anything. You just sit and talk. And for the prisoner, it's time to be removed for a while mentally from being in prison. It's just you and another person communicating like actual human beings on the street. Makes a very big difference.
Do you find, Steve, that your volunteers, do you call them visitors?
Yeah, visitors.
Do your visitors communicate in writing in between? Are they pen pals as well, or do they talk on the phone?
No. We have very strict rules. All the communication, except related to scheduling a visit, is done in person. And no writing back and forth, no telephone calls. the visitor is not there to relay messages between the prisoner and family or the prisoner and his lawyer or anything like that. It's just to be human right then and there. When a prisoner gets transferred or released, transferred to another prison or released, they end up with, if they get transferred, they end up with a different visitor at the location that they're at. And once they get released, the rules are we don't stay in touch. They can stay in touch with the organization, but not the visitor.
If I run a foundation and you're going to write to me for a grant to support prisoner visitation and support, I'm imagining the case you make is that sustaining relationships with the outside world is better when an individual is released from prison because they then integrate better with society and have a lower chance of recidivism.
Oh, yeah, that's about 80% of the pitch. Basically, there's lots of statistics, and I don't have them off the top of my head, but somebody who gets visits while they're in prison has a much lower likelihood of recidivism. The rest of the pitch is that it's moral, it's human to treat other people as humans. Many of the people we visit have life sentences, and in federal prison that actually means life. So we're visiting people till they die.
Do you have persons on death row that receive visitors?
All the time, every day. Almost every day, probably every day, there's somebody in federal prison being visited on death row or with a life sentence by a PVS visitor.
Now, I read that you also visit a few military facilities. Can you talk about that? How many military prisons are there?
There are actually only six in continental United States, and we visit in all of them, in all 122 federal prisons.
Oh, wow. In the military facilities, do you ever try to match a person with military experience as a visitor, if you have any?
We try sometimes, but in general, we just use what we have. it's a question of resources, you know, who's
right.
available there. These prisons are frequently in the middle of nowhere. You know, it's rare to have a prison in downtown somewhere. They're mostly out in cornfields 100 miles from the nearest town. So we have to work with what we got.
Now, can you give us a profile of a sort of a typical volunteer? Is it an older person? Is it a liberal person, religious?
Yeah, this is very interesting. In general, our volunteers are retired people. They've mostly been fairly successful in life because that means that they're retired. they have time. And they understand commitment, that a commitment to do something for years on end means you're going to do it for years on end. And they're like clockwork. They're very responsible, professional folks in general. That said, we have a range from low 20s to in our mid-90s of people visiting.
Wow.
From pretty much all walks of life, we even end up with people who have criminal records. I mean, I obviously have a criminal record, and I go in and out of the prisons all the time. So, yeah, we're from all walks of life. It's a very interesting group. And then you asked about religious. We have people who span the gamut. We have quite a few atheists. We have Jews, we have a lot of Quakers, we have Catholics, we have pretty much everything. We have Muslims. Any group you can think of, we've got in our group now. And because we're not proselytizing, there's no evangelical work. You can talk to a prisoner about religion if they want to, but you're not there to do that. So politically, we're also all over the gamut. A couple days ago, I was sitting down and talking to a local coordinator from Texas who was a fervent Trump supporter, which I found interesting. And, of course, we have people who actually believe in the abolition of prisons. It's the whole gamut.
Let's get to the crucial question. What do the visitors get out of this?
Well, we don't pay them. that's an interesting thing. They seem, when I talk to them, to feel that they get at least as much out of it as the prisoner does. They always come out very upbeat. You learn an awful lot, generally, about people in different walks of life that you wouldn't know anything about. Many of the prisoners are fascinating, fascinating characters. Often that's what got them there. So there's a lot to learn, and the prisoners so focused and so needy, so centered on their visitor that, you know, people like to have attention. You're getting real live attention from someone who's actually hanging on every word. So the visitors love it. They stick with us for decades and decades.
You know, Steve, I have also benefited from visiting prisoners over the years, and I think it's a transformative experience that, quite honestly, I think every individual in this country ought to be mandated to do. Of course, the difference is it is a lifelong commitment, but I think for many people who really have lived a life primarily thinking of their community, it's eye-opening, and as you said, it gives back, if not as much, more than what the prisoner who's being visited gets. I think that it's a selfless form of community service that needs to be really spread more.
Oh, my goodness, yes. You should be a pitch man for us.
I want to hear your thoughts on a recent development in terms of doing away with prisoner visits and replacing it in some states, in some facilities, with video technology. Now, I think, don't get me wrong, that video technology can enhance when a family member cannot make it to a facility or for some other logistical purpose. Let's use that. It's a great supplement, but it shouldn't, in my opinion, replace in-person visits. Is this an issue that you see? Does it impact your work in terms of some facilities won't allow your volunteers in?
Oh, greatly. It greatly impacts our work. We have no facilities that don't allow our volunteers in, but for example, at the Supermax, there's frequently units where there's no human contact allowed at all, in which case our visitors are visiting somebody through glass, which is very much like video. And actually, I think it's at Florence at the ADX, the Supermax for the federal system, where they're not even through glass. It actually is a video meeting, even though our people come to the prison and do it from a visiting room. And it's different. It's way different. There's no real human contact. It's still important, but the quality drops dramatically. And then there's the endless issue of technical problems. If anything can go wrong with technology, particularly if it's in a prison, it will. So there's frequently 2-3 months at a time where the video equipment doesn't work. It's broken. So nothing happens.
Yeah, that must be really disappointing to an expectant inmate. Looking forward to that.
The prisoners actually, this is the high point of their month, is the visit.
Yeah.
They're counting on it. They're thinking about it. This is, you know, like Christmas. And when it doesn't happen, it's quite a letdown.
You got visits,
yeah,
right.
I got visits, but when I was expecting somebody and they didn't come for one reason or another, or there was a lockdown,
yeah,
it's kind of crushing.
Were you ever in solitary? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I was, actually.
Yeah.
A few weeks, not real long.
Mm. If listeners are just joining us, we're talking with Steve Gotzler, executive director of the organization called Prison Visitation and Support. Steve, it's really a treat to talk with you. I know that before this position, and you and I have known each other for about 2 decades through the National Lawyers Guild, you were the former program director at the Pennsylvania Prison Society. Tell us a bit about that organization.
Oh, yeah, the Pennsylvania Prison Society is a fascinating place. It's, I think this year it would be 232 years old. And actually, Prisoner Visitation and Support was mildly modeled on it, started in the same city, Philadelphia, by Quakers primarily. But Pennsylvania Prison Society was begun by a lot of Quakers, but also people like Benjamin Rush and Benjamin Franklin. Their idea was that everything the government did needed oversight, and you needed to be able to walk in and look around to make sure things were going all right. So in Pennsylvania, the official visitors of the Pennsylvania Prison Society can walk into any state or county prison and go pretty much anywhere in the building and talk to prisoners. They also run programming, but they can go in and talk to prisoners anywhere in the, I think it's now 25 state prisons. So what I was doing there was, after I left the ACLU, where I was a lawyer for a long time, I started over at the Prison Society, and I set up a mentoring program. Kind of as a lark, the executive director of the Prison Society asked me, when I was released from prison, what I thought would have been helpful to me. And I started describing it to her, and she said, okay, set that up, we're going to start doing it. So we did. And it's in existence. I still run it, even though I no longer am at the Prison Society, at a state prison in Chester, Pennsylvania, and sometimes out at the new prison in Phoenix, SCI Phoenix, Pennsylvania. And what the plan is we have a pre-release class that I run for, it's all men now, I don't work with the women yet, who are about to be released and go through everything that I thought that they would need. So it's nuts and bolts. While we're going through the class, I'm kind of analyzing who the participants are. And then before they're released, I hook them up with a mentor. And they start meeting with a mentor once a week before release in the visiting room to plan out their what they're going to do when they get out. And then they keep meeting with that mentor on the street for as long as they need, an extra brain. The trick to the whole program is my mentors are all people who have fairly recently done substantial prison time, been out, and been successful. And they're all volunteers. And the fun thing about this is, so far, over 600 men have gone through my program. And my numbers aren't perfect because it is all volunteers, so I don't have great bookkeeping. But it appears to be that over 4 years, our recidivism rate is about 2%, which is absolutely insanely good. So, American University is beginning a study of the program to see if it's replicable.
Steve, that's just wonderful. In addition to the technical problems you just described, do you see a move really toward replacing in-person visits with videos?
Yeah, sadly I do. It's not like a wave, but I see cameras and video conferencing stuff being installed piecemeal here and there in different state and federal prisons, a little bit here, a little bit there. Initially, it's for people who are far away. And then slowly, it's more convenient for the staff. They don't have to staff it as heavily because there's no in-person contact. And then they can't afford to have 50 monitors, so they only have 6. So pretty soon, you've got maybe 1 staff person and 6 monitors. And nobody in the visiting room, So the labor cost is much lower. Of course, it also means there's almost no contact between prisoners and the general public. Most of these prisons have 1,000 to 2,000 people in them, and if you can do 6 visits at a time through video conference, that's almost irrelevant.
Sounds like fast food nation.
Yeah, it is. It's along those lines. Only this is desperate. Humans need human contact.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, but prison staff and the vast majority of other prisoners just barely don't quite make the grade of regular human contact.
Certainly not nurturing human contact.
No, not at all.
Steve, I want more people to know about this project. Now, you're based in Pennsylvania, but can volunteers, I assume they come from all around the country. How do they get in touch with you?
Correct. We have volunteers from all over the country, and we always need them. There is no limit to how many volunteers we can handle.
Great.
We have waiting lists at almost every prison in the country.
Ugh.
How they can contact me or us is they can go to prisonervisitation.org, or you could just Google prisoner visitation, and it will take you to us.
Now, before we wrap up, I can't believe this half hour has gone so quickly. How in-depth is the screening process for applicants?
Oh, it's actually pretty serious. We only accept probably 25% of the applicants.
Competitive.
Actually competitive to volunteer. We're looking for people who don't have an outside agenda.
Yeah.
And for people who can actually commit to a long, constant, you know, responsibly showing up. The last thing you want to do is commit to somebody who's in prison and then vanish on them. They're used to being vanished on, and what they need is a little consistency.
That's got to be heartbreaking.
Yeah, it is.
Steve Gotzler, we're running out of time. We're going to have to say goodbye, but I want to first commend you on your really impressive track record of working on behalf of social justice and specifically prisoners' rights. We'd like to have you back on periodically to check in with you and to talk about the state of what I see as the corporatization of our prison system and what that means for humanity.
Love to be back.
All right, Steve. Thank you. And we'll put a link to your program on our website.
Thank you very much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
In a unanimous decision, the U.S. Supreme Court recently ruled that the Constitution limits the ability of state and local law enforcement to seize the cash, property, and other assets that may have been used in the commission of crimes, especially when they use it to fill the coffers of police departments. Law enforcement need only suspect the property has been used in a crime. They actually don't need to charge you. Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote the opinion on her first day back at court. Civil liberties organizations have criticized this practice for years. That's because many local governments use the fines to raise revenue, increasing incentives for arrest. Not surprisingly, civil asset forfeiture disproportionately affects vulnerable communities, notably African Americans and lower-income neighborhoods. In the state of South Carolina, for example, the Greenville News reported that the state took $17 million from seizures from 2014 to 2016. 65% of those targeted were African American. The High Court said in this case that fines may not be excessive and that states are currently using excessive fines for improper purposes, including for raising revenue. Note, this ruling does not put an end to the practice. It creates a way for lawyers to more effectively challenge illegal civil asset forfeitures. Today we listen to a 2017 Law and Disorder interview with attorney Josie Duffy Rice of the Fair Punishment Project. That was when then U.S. Attorney Jeff Sessions announced plans to actually increase the use of civil forfeiture. Let's take a listen. Josie Duffy Rice, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, we've done several segments over the past few years on issues related to civil forfeiture, but how would you describe the downsides of this practice?
I would say that there's nothing but downsides to civil forfeiture. When the government is willing to, and law enforcement is willing to take property from people who have not been charged with a crime, much less convicted, you have a system where you are being forced to give up property for something you didn't do wrong, or haven't been proven to do wrong yet. I mean, that's the real problem with civil asset forfeiture. It's being punished for, what's the phrase that I'm trying to think of?
Innocent until proven guilty.
You're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. And when with civil asset forfeiture, I mean, it's one of the things in law enforcement we see where you're actually guilty, assumed to be guilty before anything has been filed.
Exactly. And really, mostly unable to go before a judge. A lot of these are administrative proceedings.
Yes.
How difficult is it to get a person's property or money back after it's been seized? What obstacles are there?
Well, in civil asset forfeiture, often the burden of proof is on the person who's had their assets seized and not actually on the law enforcement. So you have to take time out of your day, take money, take space, and go and try to prove or demonstrate that this piece of property, whether it be your car, your house, money, was not used for criminal purposes and advancement of a crime. And depending on how bad law enforcement wants to keep your property, which, spoiler alert, it's usually very, very badly that they want to keep your property, it can take months, it can take years to get, you know, something that you worked hard for back. It's very difficult when the burden of proof is on the citizen or the resident versus the government.
Especially when the person whose assets have been seized may not have resources
to mount
legal defense.
Are you telling me that you have to prove a negative?
You have to prove a negative.
How do you prove a negative?
Right. I mean, this is the fundamental, and this is one of the fundamental tenets of our criminal justice system, right, is that the burden of proof should be on the state. That is supposed to be how this system works. But when in a civil system, which is normally just you and I going back and forth in court, not me going against the government, the burden of proof is different. And the evidence standard is different. And so what we're seeing is that for criminal cases, civil rules are applied to criminal cases. And that's an abuse of government power.
Yeah.
It's a real abuse of law enforcement power.
Yeah, in criminal cases, there's a higher burden, beyond a reasonable doubt.
Beyond a reasonable doubt. And that you would imagine that would be the burden of proof if your assets are forfeited because you have supposedly been engaged in a criminal enterprise. But that's not the case.
Josie, talk, if you will, about the racial implications in this practice of civil forfeiture.
Absolutely. So the people that tend to have their things taken are the people who won't fight back. I mean, there are cases where drug gangs have millions of dollars taken, you know, seized. But in reality, the everyday practice of civil forfeiture is taking from people who can't fight back. And so often, that's people of color, that's poor people. You know, their studies have shown that it's people of color are way more likely to have their assets taken than white people. What you see is it's a replication of a pattern we see all the time in law enforcement, which is it is a power balance, a power dynamic, and that law enforcement is more tends to abuse that power around with people, with communities that have sort of historically been disenfranchised, historically had to deal with tough law enforcement, historically had to deal with unfair law enforcement practices.
Josie, it's my understanding that if local law enforcement gets involved in a federal forfeiture action, they're actually paid kind of a bounty by the feds for participating.
Right, right. So there's the thing called the Equitable Sharing Program, which at its most simple means that local law enforcement can seize, in many cases, local property and work with the federal government or can find local property, work with the federal government to seize it and take some of the profits of the actual seizure. So in the Equitable Sharing Program, often, you know, the benefit to it is that in some states, when you seize assets, all the money may go into a general fund or it may go to a lot of different agencies. With the federal program, the money ends up going back to the law enforcement agencies directly. So you're more likely to get a bigger share of that money. And what we see is that, you know, the federal government is helping local law enforcement sort of take people's property all of the time by helping them seize it, taking a large portion of this of the actual seizure profits, but then giving another portion of that back to the states, back to the localities.
It's funny. A friend recently showed me a website called PropertyRoom.com, which is jewelry, watches, cars seized by the government that people bid on. And so I guess that when cash is given directly to either local or federal law enforcement, and we're talking not just police departments, but the Drug Enforcement Agency, Immigration, ICE, the IRS, Department of Homeland Security, all of these law enforcement agencies profit from these forfeitures. But on PropertyRoom.com, and I'm sure there are many other sites like that, I guess that's how they take turn the property into dollars that then goes to the departments. But how can these agencies be impartial in enforcing the law if their own budgets perhaps are strained and they're trying to get a piece of the pie? It's sort of like after 9/11, pots of money were available for local law enforcement you could apply to DHS. Right. You had to show there were sort of terrorist threats in your area. So isn't that a problem?
Yes, and it really does. I mean, civil forfeiture has, there are so many problems with it. And one problem with it is what you just said, that we have a law enforcement system that in many places is strained, doesn't have enough money to actually carry out day-to-day practices. And that goes for the local prosecutor's office. It goes for the local police. And what it means is they end up having to make money off of people's backs, right? You see it in bail. You see it all the time with fees and fines. Constantly, if you're involved in the criminal justice system, and with civil forfeiture, I mean, that's even an exaggeration, right? Your kid may be involved in the criminal justice system. Your neighbor, some guy borrowed your car, and now they're saying they need to take your car because that guy maybe one day had drugs. The connection is so tenuous. And what we're seeing is it's just another example of law enforcement at best trying to make up for budgetary constraints, at worst trying to make a couple extra bucks left and right. Either way, that's not the average citizen's responsibility to be, you know, funding law enforcement through illegal actions because they don't have enough money to do it themselves.
I understand that in a recent poll, 84% of Americans indicated they oppose civil forfeiture. And even Justice Clarence Thomas recognized in a concurring Supreme Court opinion that, quote, forfeiture operations frequently target the poor and other groups least able to defend their interests, as you've explained. Why do you think Attorney General Sessions has recently called for reinstatement of civil forfeiture? What's his rationale?
Well, I mean, I would argue that Attorney General Sessions is constantly doing things that pull badly. He is fundamentally a very big believer in law enforcement. And what law enforcement would say is the reason for civil forfeiture. It stops people from committing crimes. It helps fund the kind of big investigations, the big actions that we need. It takes the actual stuff that's being taken away is from people who have done serious wrongs. The reality is that there are stories, there are such horror stories about civil forfeiture. There was one I was reading today about parents who had their house seized when their child was charged with $40 possession of heroin. I mean, their house was taken. You know, I don't know that Attorney General Sessions could justify that. I don't know how he could. Now, he may be able to say the entire practice, in theory, has some benefits. And I don't think that that's actually how it plays out on the ground. But that's the argument he would make. And that's the argument that law enforcement would make. And you can imagine that if you're getting millions of dollars a year from a practice that's ostensibly legal, you're going to find a way to justify it. Yeah. I spend a lot of time talking to bail bond companies, and they do this, you know, the same sort of logic of, well, if we don't do this, then how are we going to keep the streets safe? Or, you know, there's a lot of self-justification that happens in the law enforcement parties and the parties that kind of surround it.
Yeah, I had another horror story that I'll share with you.
Yes, please.
Of an attorney up in the Catskills who had a little summer house up there. And there was a helicopter overflight, and they saw that the guy was growing a marijuana plant, and they got his house.
Right.
I mean, I guess you read about stories like that all the time.
I'm always just surprised, and I mean, I'm shocked. There was a great New York article about this about 4 years ago, and people will be driving. This was in a small town in Texas. People are driving through the town with their families on the way to vacation. The cops stop them, and they say, "We have evidence, or we suspect you're transferring drugs, or you've transferred drugs in this car, or we smell marijuana on you." And they take their car. You know, they just take their car. You're on vacation with your family. And the next day, your kids are in the car, you know. And then, people are not prepared for the fact that this is actually possible. It seems so unbelievable.
But they're trying to reform this practice in New Mexico, Nebraska.
They have.
Talk to us about that.
So both New Mexico and Nebraska have outlawed civil asset forfeiture. They have gotten rid of it. What they have done now is that you have to be convicted of a crime to have your property taken. And I don't want to get too in the weeds, but with civil asset forfeiture, it basically means that the government is bringing is an action against a thing, right? They're not saying to the parents of the kid who had $40 of heroin, they're not saying, "We think you committed a crime, so we're taking your property." They say, "We think a crime was committed on this property, in this property, et cetera, so we're taking the property." And all we have to show, and maybe not even show, is a preponderance of the evidence that a crime could have been committed in this property. With criminal asset forfeiture, when to actually have something taken because of an actual criminal case against a person, You're bringing a charge against a person. You need to prove, theoretically, that beyond a reasonable doubt, this person committed a crime. And that the actual property is seized sort of in tandem with the person versus on its own with the thing. That might feel a little vague and intangible. But the reason that it matters is that it's very easy to say that a piece of property could have been connected to something along the way. That's a very, very low standard to prove. And it's a very different story. I mean, there are arguments that even criminal forfeiture is very abused. But it's not abused in the same way that civil forfeiture is. And at least you need a conviction, right? Right now, you don't even need a charge.
Right. And part of the problem, I guess a large part, is that these are administrative proceedings. They're not before a judge. So the standards are different.
Right. I mean, there are different kinds of proceedings, but often they are administrative. They're in civil practice and not criminal. And, you know, they happen sort of under the radar. And this happens so much in law enforcement, right? You know, my dream is to just get someone to sit in a court, every court in America, all day long, so I could just get an actual sense of what's happening, because it's very difficult to follow these cases. You know, a lot of people who are having their stuff taken, maybe it's $1,000, but you make $25,000 a year and you have three kids. And so it's hard to get the local newspaper to care about $1,000, or it's hard to spend a lot of time on that because you have other stuff to do. So many of these stories are not even told. You're not even seeing them.
I was struck in the story that we mentioned in our introduction was about a manager of a band that had gone on tour to raise money to give for charitable purposes, and he had all the money they raised in cash in the car. And during a routine traffic stop, the officer said that a dog had sniffed and alerted them there might be drugs. And so they seized the cash.
Right.
As you say, it's sort of like on the property. And that reminds us of a segment we did a while back on how small businesses who deal primarily in cash transactions have been targeted as well.
Yep.
And
yeah,
that's, again, businesses that can't afford to charge everything hits those. We were interested, Josie, in the Fair Punishment Project. If you could tell us a bit about its work and, if you don't mind, how you came to be involved in this.
Yeah, so I was previously a journalist who covered mostly prosecutors. And I came to the Fair Punishment Project because of the groups, you know, they sort of lead the way in prosecutor-related research on prosecutor-related issues as related to criminal justice. So we do a lot of things. We have some excellent journalists on staff who we work with to kind of tell the big stories. Karima Towns is the one who told the story on civil forfeiture in New Mexico and Nebraska. And we work with law fellows and legal scholars to actually look into sort of the practices of prosecutors across the nation. So we spend a lot of time looking at who's violating evidence laws, who is locking people up for high amounts of bail when they don't deserve it, who is finding excuses to lock up kids, who is putting kids, you know, sentencing kids to life without parole for something they did as a juvenile, who is punishing poverty. And this is another example, not necessarily of punishing poverty, but using people's property and their money to kind of put them in a constant cycle of punishment. And what we are a project between Harvard Law School, the Bronx Defenders, and the Accountable Justice Collaborative. And we have some really excellent people on staff doing really, really excellent work. And so it's really been an honor for me to work there. I just started 6 months ago, but I love it so far.
And how did you come to be interested in social justice and the law?
Oh, that's I like that question. Before I went to law school, I worked at the Bronx Defenders, at the Public Defender's Office, and I was the assistant to the executive director, Robin Steinberg, who kind of, you know, started the Bronx Defenders 20 years ago with sort of a vision of what public defense could really look like. And I had been interested in criminal justice as a general term, but I didn't really know the specifics. And I remember going there the first day and walking by the courthouse and seeing the long line of people who could have been working, who had kids, who, you know, had these court dates that you could just see that this, how much influence and what a burden the criminal justice system was on the South Bronx community. You could see it with your eyes all the time. And not to pit public defender's offices against each other. The Bronx Defenders is just one of the most incredible places I've ever seen. I'm very glad I went there so early because it meant to me that criminal justice reform had to be the focus of my life. And now, you know, in this new era with Attorney General Sessions at the helm, how we treat people in prison or people in the criminal justice system is really just an indication of what we're willing to do to everybody. It really is about civil liberties. It really is about justice. It really is about what, as a country and as a state, we believe, what rights we believe that people are entitled to. And, you know, civil asset forfeiture is an example of the fact that we live in a place where law enforcement is willing to take your stuff without charging you of a crime. That's considered acceptable. And to me, that's not just a problem for everybody who may actually have their stuff taken. It's a problem for me. I've never had my stuff taken, but it opens up the world of possibilities of what could happen to any of us at any second. And to me, that just stands against what this country is supposed to stand for. So now I'm in it. I can't get out. I'm stuck.
You're in it.
Be doing this work forever.
We're talking with Attorney Josie Duffy Rice of the Fair Punishment Project. How do people get a hold of the project if they want to?
So we are on Twitter, which is a big thing for us. We're very excited. We're at Fair Punishment. You can always reach out to me. My email is josie.duffy, D-U-F-F-Y, .rice@fairpunishment. And we and all of our research and all of our reports are on at fairpunishment.org. Our goal is to do a couple of things. We want to know about these issues. When people have stories of assets being seized, when they have stories of the local prosecutor abusing power or maybe doing excellent work and think they need to be highlighted, when they have stories of their son or their student or their cousin going through a process that just to them is such a reflection of how unjust the system is, those are stories we want to hear. We want to know. I mean, there are 2,300 prosecutors in America, so we can't keep really great tabs on there. We have 25 people on staff, so we do the best we can, but we really do rely on the general public and people who are actually in this system to tell us what's actually going on.
Josie, it's really been a pleasure to meet you and to have you on Law and Disorder.
Yes, thank you.
We'd
this
like
is great.
To have you on again.
I'd love to.
You reminded me of that famous quote from Clarence Darrow, that there's no justice in the courthouse or outside of it.
Yes. Yeah, we're working on it. Well, I keep telling my husband, I'm like, by the time, in 50 years, I will stop talking about this all the time. By then, I'm sure everything will be figured out. It's a nice spot, at least.
Well, Josie, thank you for your commitment and have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you, Josie.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. You can get the show on there. You can ask questions. You can email us. We want to hear from you.